Illinois' response to the novel coronavirus has raised a lot of questions. We've been collecting yours, and this morning we'll answer a few of them. Then we revisit my conversation with novelist and Illinois native Dave Eggers, whose latest book, The Captain and the Glory, is an allegory about a large cruise ship that replaces a respected, experienced captain with someone who is none of those things.
It might sound like it has parallels to our political moment and who we elected to the White House a few years ago. Those are just purely circumstantial.
Plus, almost every type of public entertainment venue in Illinois remains closed. One exception, drive-in movie theaters. We'll talk to two owners about their plans for the summer. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. A production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Tuesday morning, Illinois is reporting just over 79,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and 3,459 deaths. And Governor Pritzker says the peak of cases here, which had been expected this month, is now not likely to come until June. Pritzker was taking questions Monday afternoon from reporters via video conference in his home, where he'll be working for a while after a member of his staff tested positive for COVID-19. The governor says he's been tested since learning of the case in his office and has so far been negative. At the start of our show today, we want to take a few of your questions. AskTheNewsroom.com from Illinois Newsroom is collecting questions from listeners related to COVID-19 in Illinois, and public radio reporters are working to answer them. Many of the submissions are financial questions and health questions, so we've invited two journalists on the 21st today to help provide some insight based on their reporting during the pandemic. Christine Herman is a health reporter at WILL's Illinois Newsroom and Side Effects Public Media. Christine, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Brian.
And we're also joined by Sam Dunklaw, a reporter with NPR Illinois in Springfield. Sam, thanks for coming on the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And you can view answers to past questions at IllinoisNewsroom.com or ask a question, and reporters will do their best to answer it. Sam, I want to begin with you. Our first question is related to the five-phase plan to reopen Illinois that Governor Pritzker announced during a press conference exactly 1 week ago. Can you briefly explain to us what that plan is?
Yeah, Brian. So as you mentioned, the plan is in five phases. So the Pritzker administration aims to slowly reopen the state in phases and potentially according to region. The phase that we're in right now means that we are flattening the curve. The title of the phase is flattening. At this phase, cases and deaths, of course, are still occurring, but they are not dramatically increasing like we saw over the last couple of months. So some non-essential businesses are open. Bars and restaurants and things like health clubs, of course, are still closed. After this phase, we'll slowly move then to phase three if certain metrics are met. If positivity rates in all of the regions or even in some of them stay at 20% or lower, and then hospitals need to be able to have surge capacity meeting certain metrics. After that, phase three is titled recovery. We're starting to recover from the peak of COVID-19 cases. That's when more non-essential businesses will open and groups of no more than 10 will be able to start gathering. And again, the positivity rate has to stay at a certain level, and hospitals need to be able to have a certain surge capacity in case things get worse. After that, phase four comes into play, potentially. Revitalization is what the plan titles it. At that point, larger groups will be able to get together, at least 50 people, and some more non-essential businesses like bars and restaurants, of course, that we've been talking about for a number of months, will be then able to start open. The last phase of the plan, Brian, only occurs and we can only move to that if and when a vaccine or effective treatment comes into play. Mm-hmm. And that is when the state will be able to come back to its full course.
Yeah, it hasn't caught on yet. I'm trying to get people to call that VC Day, Victory Over Coronavirus Day. But yeah, even phase four, which is where you'd have schools reopening and restaurants reopening, that is quite a ways off for most of the state, even on the sort of if everything goes as Governor Pritzker has laid it out. Christine, we have a question specifically about one phase of Pritzker's plan. It's from Heather in Naperville. She asks, once we enter phase three and groups of 10 are permitted, what will be the face mask and social distancing expectations within the group? Do we know if people will have to continue wearing masks when the groups smaller than 10 people are allowed to gather in phase three, Christine?
Yeah, so Brian, what I've learned is that really until there's a vaccine or a known herd immunity, meaning, you know, we know that people have immunity against COVID-19 because they've been previously exposed and that's at a high enough level, that really until either of those two things happen, that masks will be the norm. That's what I learned from speaking with Champaign-Urbana Public Health's Administrator Julie Pride. She said, you know, we're in this for the long haul. We should be prepared to be wearing masks for a long time, social distancing. That would be my understanding that even once we're into phase three, that would continue to be the case. And, you know, vaccine development takes time. It could be, you know, another year until that's really an option. So the idea with masks, again, you know, anyone over age two who's medically able to wear the masks, the idea is it's a simple way to prevent the spread of your germs to other people.
And Christine, related to the face mask, Illinois newsrooms, askthenewsroom.com, received several questions about how to properly wear a mask, or maybe a better way to put it would be calling people out for not properly wearing a mask. We had one person who wrote a question after Governor Pritzker's daily press conference. This comes from Mary, who says, "Hello, I am a nurse. This is not a criticism, but I am concerned about Governor Pritzker and the other speakers touching the podium after each other. I'm also concerned about their laying their mask on the podium or folding it and putting it in a pocket. A review of how to wear a mask so as not to contaminate yourself and others would be helpful and helpful to the public so that everyone is using a mask safely." Well, given that the administration are all doing their news conferences from their residences now as they are quarantining themselves after somebody tested positive, I think we can rest easily about the message we might be sending to the public. But Christine, we know we should be wearing masks in public, but how do you wear a mask properly and make sure your mask isn't contaminating surfaces or being contaminated, like Mary mentioned?
This is really important, and there's really good guidance from CDC both on how to properly wear a mask as well as how to make your own mask with materials you might have at home if you're not able to buy one. Or sew one, or you know, acquire one some other way. So there's also, you know, I think the most important things that I've seen from medical experts and public health officials is the mask should cover your nose and your chin. It should be fitted to your face so that there are no gaps. And when you take off and, you know, put on your mask, you only should be touching the ties, not the front of it. The idea being that, you know, the whole point of the mask is to collect, you know, prevent any respiratory particles from your body from, you know, being released into the air and being, you know, contracted by other people. So, and then of course, washing your hands before putting on or taking off your mask is important. And I think, you know, the most helpful thing for people to do would probably be to check out the CDC's guidance on that. There's a lot of information out there on how to properly, you know, proper mask hygiene.
Yeah, and Christine, I was out on an essential run this weekend. I went to the hardware store because I had a sink backed up in my bathroom. Sorry for the TMI people, but I understand that stores can refuse service if people aren't wearing a mask. I still saw a surprising number. Most people were wearing masks, but there were still a few who weren't. Are stores required to ask their customers to wear masks? How does that work?
That's a great question. And I don't know clearly who is the one to be enforcing this. I mean, we've had news conferences with local law enforcement who have basically said it's very difficult to figure out enforcement. They can't go policing door to door, business to business. So what should people do? I mean, I asked Julie Pride from Champaign-Urbana Public Health, what should you do if you see employees at a store or customers who aren't wearing masks? Because, you know, as we know, the requirement now is to wear masks in public, in buildings, anywhere where you can't social distance of 6 feet of other people, you're supposed to have a mask on. So what should you do? I mean, she said really the first thing you should do is talk to the manager and say, as a patron of this business, I don't feel protected, you know, without your employees or without a requirement for other people to be wearing a mask. And of course, you can contact your local public health department if you feel, you know, that people aren't complying or that employers aren't, you know, providing masks to their employees or requiring it of customers. And they can also help get involved with the education component of that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. We're answering your questions about the coronavirus in Illinois and the state's response to it. We're joined by health reporter Christine Herman from WILL and Illinois Newsroom. We're also joined by Sam Dunklow, a reporter with NPR Illinois in Springfield. And the questions that we're discussing were submitted to askthenewsroom.com. You can go there to find responses or ask a question, and Illinois Newsroom reporters will work on an answer for you. Sam, we got a few questions related to finances, particularly when it comes to unemployment, including this question from Ashley, who writes, I know unemployment has gone up because of the virus and they're working hard, but I feel so lost as to what I should expect. It's been almost 2 weeks since I've applied, and I have not had any information about how long it should take, what my next steps are, etc. Can someone really just clarify what the process is right now? I just want to know what's going on. Thank you. Sam, can you tell us what the process is right now when it comes to unemployment?
Yeah, so Brian, I did a little digging on this, and the Department of Employment Security does have some pretty good information on this. So it sounds like Ashley, as you mentioned, has filed a claim. So you file a claim, that's the application process you undertake to determine whether or not you qualify for unemployment benefits. And what happens, the next process is the department certifies whether, you know, your application. So that's the process that occurs 2 weeks after you filed your claim. So Ashley had said that it's been almost 2 weeks. Based on the sound of that, she should be expecting the department to be contacting her to begin the certification process. Anybody who's on unemployment has to certify with the department every 2 weeks to say that you're available for work, that you're actively seeking work. You have to report any income that you have received also at that time. So certification essentially involves a list of answering questions to determine whether you're eligible to receive the unemployment benefits. You know, you put initial information on your application, but the department is going to scrutinize that a little bit. You're then assigned a certification day, and you'll be then asked those questions about 2 weeks roughly after you've applied. So once you're certified, it'll be determined if you're available and eligible for benefits. You'll essentially then receive payment on a preloaded debit card or on another payment method that you provide to the department within 2 to 3 business days. It's also important, I think, Brian, to mention to those that are either on unemployment or who are interested in applying that those benefits are taxable at the state and federal level. And if you have workers' comp or you are receiving a pension, that will affect the amount that you can receive.
Hmm. So we have another question related to finances, not so much getting paid, but people trying to get a payment from you. Well, not you, Sam, but from people sure. out there. The question is, please be advised during the COVID-19 pandemic, creditors are being relentless. This is happening to those unemployed and even to those who are elderly who pay in a timely fashion but can't get out to pay their bills. Will Governor Pritzker place a moratorium against creditors that are affecting credit scores negatively and even threatening judgment against Illinoisans who are already faced with challenges just to sustain livelihoods? Sam, do we know, are there protections against creditors right now in Illinois?
So what is in place right now is some guidance from the Department of Financial and Professional Regulation that regulates those creditors, debtors, and other folks like that. That guidance has essentially stated that any creditor, including student loan servicers, collection agencies, people who are being hounded for debt, need to work with the consumers that they that owe them money to accommodate hardships. I mean, that's their wording. The IDFPR has recommended a suspension of collection for a period of at least 60 days. Again, that's more guidance. That is not the moratorium that was suggested in the question. Although I did pose the question to Governor Pritzker yesterday. He had said that he is considering how, you know, a moratorium or some hard in stone guidance might come out of his administration. He's been talking to creditors about that. It's part of a so-called broader issue, or a broader effort, rather, to address that issue. So I guess the short answer is Right now, IDFPR has some guidance out. Creditors are really supposed to be giving people at least 2 months of breathing room. But more importantly, they should be working with individual debtors to come to some kind of agreement.
So, Christine, just a couple of minutes left in the segment, and I want to get back to one of the health questions submitted to Illinois Newsroom's Ask the Newsroom. Diane wrote in and said, up until recently, it was advised that people who are ill but not seriously so should just stay at home and not go to be tested. Is that still the case, or are we trying to get as many tested as possible to ascertain how many people have contracted the virus? Christine, what'd you find out about testing?
Yeah, so I asked Dr. Ngozi Ezike from the Illinois Department of Public Health about this at a recent press briefing. She said that, you know, anyone who's been exposed to someone with a confirmed case of COVID-19, they obviously qualify for testing. You know, it's not required, but it's recommended because, well, one, it can provide peace of mind to know if you have COVID-19 or not, but it can also help public health officials mitigate the spread, because once they have a confirmed case, they go through a process of contact tracing. They figure out, with your help, who were you in contact with, you know, a certain period of time prior to the onset of your symptoms or when you got confirmed. You know, and so for others who don't have known exposure but are experiencing what they think might be COVID-19 symptoms, here's what Dr. Ezike said about that.
If they're not in the high-risk category and are able to stay at home, they're able to care for themselves, if they're able to connect with a medical provider and just check in case the symptoms did progress, that is fine. If the person wanted to know for sure, be added to the count, that is fine too. So it's not a directive in terms of what the right way to proceed. Either is fine, but the most important thing is probably to talk with a medical provider and make sure that you're sharing your symptoms so that we can make sure that there's not a point where the symptoms progress that needs acute medical care.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to let Dr. Ezike have the last word on our question and answer segment. Christine Herman from WILL and Illinois Newsroom and Sam Dunklaw from NPR Illinois, thanks so much for being here and answering questions today.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you.
And keep your questions coming at askthenewsroom.com. More to come in a moment.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Over the past two decades, author and journalist Dave Eggers has written more than a dozen books, from a critically acclaimed memoir to a dystopian tech saga. Eggers is a native of Illinois and went to the journalism school at the University of Illinois in Urbana. He also founded the national tutoring nonprofit 826 Valencia and started the literary magazine and humor website McSweeney's. His latest book is The Captain and the Glory, an allegory about the current American political scene. I spoke with Eggers in December, which is when we first broadcast this interview. As you're listening, keep in mind that impeachment was in the news, the pandemic was not. Eggers also had been attending Trump rallies since 2016, and some of those experiences are reflected in the novella. Dave Eggers, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So your latest book is called The Captain and the Glory. I've heard it referred to as a satire, an allegory. It's about a ship run as a democracy that decides to replace a beloved experienced captain with someone whom, as you write, all the passengers knew to be clownish and not the least bit qualified. How did this book come about?
Well, it might sound like it has parallels to our political moment and who we elected to the White House a few years ago. Those are just purely circumstantial. There's no direct reference implied.
I think your copyright page, which I've always learned to read since your first book many years ago, but it says, any resemblance to nefarious public officials responsible for the suffering of countless innocents is entirely metaphorical.
I forgot I wrote that. Yeah, I... You know, when I've been covering the Trump era as a journalist, and Most recently, I was at the rally in Hershey, the day Hershey, Pennsylvania, the day that the articles of impeachment were handed down. And I learned so much by meeting Trump voters and trying to cover it soberly and really listen to people. And I always come away edified, and I come away my faith in people restored when you really listen to their reasoning. And but then at the same time, I take a few steps back every week, and I, you know, see the towering absurdity of the last 3 years and what we're going through as a country. And so I thought, in addition to covering it journalistically, I thought it might be appropriate satire, and a sort of an allegorical satire might be the best way to really match the bizarreness and really capture the truth of it in a way that sort of straight up journalism really can't.
Yeah, you know, you talked about going to the rally, and in my day job, I'm a political reporter myself, so I too have talked to Trump supporters, and they seem, not the cartoon that is often portrayed, I think. And I wonder, how did you want them to come across in the book? Because it felt sympathetic at times, and then definitely not so much at other times.
Yeah, I think, you know, I always have the best conversations with voters on either side, but especially at these rallies. I learned so much, and they're always reasonable and always have very understandable reasons, I think, for supporting Trump, and also very narrow reasons. Like, you know, this most recent rally, somebody said, well, there's $2,500 more in my pocket this year than last year, and that's just hard to debate. When, their 401ks are growing, all of these sort of pocketbook issues that are really sort of hard to argue with. And so, but at the same time, at the rallies and in general, there's kind of a glee that I think can get very ugly and I think very disturbing, the glee with which as a group, when you see 11,000 people sort of chanting, lock her up, or 11,000 people cheering, you know, the building of the wall, or, you know, some of these sort of more punitive and ungenerous policies. I think that I wanted to capture that too. So in the book, there's a group of supporters that call themselves the most foul, because somebody had said, why would we support a candidate who is, you know, the most foul of anybody on board the ship. So they adopt that, they co-opt it, they call themselves the most foul, and they dress in chicken costumes. And I thought that there's a little bit of a parallel there, because as reasonable individually as so many Trump voters are, collectively they can create a real sort of a sometimes insensitive and menacing and atmosphere for anyone that sort of doesn't conform to their worldview. And so, again, I had to heighten things here and maybe exaggerate a bit to sort of capture what I think is the true impact. Not necessarily, you know, get into the subtleties and the nuance of it, but heighten it a bit, because the power of Trump's words and the power of the ideology and the power of his so-called movement is one very often of menace, very often of fear, and very often one that creates an uncomfortable environment for tens of millions of people in this country, especially those people who might be considered, other, you know, people of color, immigrants, children of immigrants, all of these groups that Trump has explicitly or implicitly threatened.
Certain people in your book, CP.
Certain people.
Yeah, and the captain's choices about how he deals with those certain people do make even some of the most foul, the supporters of the captain in your book, uncomfortable. But at least he's something different, right? You see the phrase, he's shaking things up. And I wonder, is that something you still hear from supporters of
Absolutely.
The president?
You know what was weird is, the last guy I interviewed, second to last guy I interviewed in Hershey, Pennsylvania, he was wearing a Santa hat that said, Make America Great. He had Trump buttons top to bottom. But he was really eloquent. and, you know, really talkative and open and, you know, thoughtful. And he thought that Hillary Clinton was a crook. He thought the Bidens were crooks. I mean, a lot of this stuff was very fed, you know, what you'd expect, sort of Fox News tropes. But then, you know, he liked Trump because he talked straight and all of these things that we hear, that he talks straight and that he's a disruptor. And then 17 minutes into this conversation, because I looked down at my tape, and it was 17 minutes in that he revealed that he voted for Obama twice, 2008 and 2012, and he even worked for Obama in 2008. And what was important to him was the purity of conviction, that Obama was an honest guy who told it straight, who, you know, came out of nowhere, had new ideas, and had a certain purity about him. He didn't have a checkered past, I guess, were in this voter's eyes. And Trump, in the same way, felt to him like the same kind of person, a disruptor, somebody new, somebody not tainted by the politics of Washington. And so for him, the Romneys, Clintons, and Bidens are not appealing because they seem corrupted, and the Trumps and the Obamas are in a different category as having been coming from outside that system and therefore more appealing, more pure. So it's a very interesting algorithm that he's going by. But you hear it again and again. A lot of Obama voters became Trump voters.
Yeah, and people used to say that President Obama was the first Twitter president. Now, I think that is kind of a quaint notion.
Yeah, not at all. They said he was the first internet president and the first Twitter president, but he was still conforming to very established norms about having his messages looked over by so many people, vetted by lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. So those communications were traditional presidential communications. They just happened to be delivered through this relatively new medium. But Trump is truly the first internet president because everything that nobody's looking at what he writes before it's delivered. It's reactionary, it's misspelled, it's ludicrous, it's full of inaccuracies, it is peddles in conspiracies, it's threatening, it's hate-filled, all of these things that, you know, occupy the darker corners of the internet and of Twitter. And so in that way, he most aptly mirrors the worst impulses made possible by social media.
Yeah, and I want to come back to social media, but while we're talking about the president and Twitter and the internet and how his supporters react to it, I don't know if candor is the right word, but it does feel like this matrix-like pipeline we have into his inner life. And I wonder, how did you think about the president as the internet as you were writing this book?
I think that that's the most interesting thing, is that even when his supporters acknowledge that he lies, first of all, they say all politicians lie. And so that's just excused very quickly. And then secondly, his candor when he tells lies makes him more truthful. And there's this pretzel logic that rules here, where it says, if you speak candidly, off the cuff, without notes, whatever you say is implicitly more true than were you to read from a piece of paper or a teleprompter. So it's like, I've seen and heard that said in dozens of ways, hundreds of times, that that's the appeal. And when I saw this last rally, I was on the floor with about 1,000 people on the floor, and there were 10,000 people in the stands, and he really does just talk off the cuff for an hour and 20 minutes in this case about, and it does feel like you are getting the completely unfiltered thoughts of a septuagenarian man with incredible power. And there is a thrill to that you can feel in the room, that you are just getting it straight. You're drinking from the fire hose, and no matter what he says that is unpresidential or untruthful, there is that incredible electric glee that goes through that audience thinking like, wow, we really shouldn't be hearing this. This is so unprecedented. It's so undignified. It's so unrehearsed. And but there's that kind of naughty thrill, I guess, that you get from hearing somebody that really should not be speaking this way as president doing so. And at the same time, you know, he puts on a show for stretches at a time. It is incredibly entertaining, maybe in that sort of train wreck sort of way. You don't know what's going to happen next. But he really knows how to put on a show, and that's why so many tens of thousands of people come to these rallies, because A, they're free, and B, you know it's going to be a good show one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with the writer Dave Eggers. His latest book is The Captain and the Glory. It's an allegory about the present situation in American politics, I'll say. I want to pause on our discussion of the book to talk about your youth. One of the reasons we wanted to have you on the 21st is that you are from Illinois, grew up in the Chicago suburbs. How do you think coming of age in the Midwest informed your creative life?
Well, the Chicago suburbs, I don't know if there's any better place to grow up as a kid. So I feel very lucky to have been raised in that very comfortable, I mean, almost bubble-like atmosphere that we grew up in, where there was the lake and trees and valleys and, you know, we had a creek. I mean, it was a drainage ditch, but it was a creek running behind our house that we thought was the Mississippi.
Too.
Yeah. Lord knows what was in there and what kind of toxins were seeping into the water. But that said, you know, I'm very proud to have been from the Midwest. I do think that the Midwest grows very good people. And then I went to school downstate in Champaign-Urbana and for college and learned so much there, too, and got to meet people from every other part of the state. You know, I feel like it gives you a real bedrock set of values and an awareness of every walk of life, because there is every kind of person, even in, you know, the one state of Illinois. I met so many people from farming communities and so many people from you know, the western suburbs, the north suburbs, the middle of the state, the southern part of the state. I think I think I learned a lot more having gone to that big state school, where so many of my friends were working their way through. So many of my friends were in the National Guard and got called up during the first Iraq War. Then I would have, I don't know, I guess going to a small liberal arts college out east or something, where there can be a certain sameness of the people that go there, and there's a lot of wealth in it. Illinois, there was real socioeconomic diversity, and I wouldn't have traded it for the world.
So when you're going to school at the U of I, I gather a lot of your journalism training, and you did, we should say, if we didn't, train as a journalist, old school Chicago Tribune guys. Do you ever think about a version of your life where you, I don't know, went to work for the News Gazette, worked your way up to the Tribune, and then take a buyout, laid off in the Great Recession, and you're now the vice president for corporate communications at a chain of hospitals or something?
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, well, I mean, I was an art major for my first couple of years. I wanted to be a painter, and I came into the Daily Illini, the daily paper there, as a cartoonist, really. Well, I mean, a photographer first. I used to shoot the Fighting Illini on the floor of, Assembly Hall. And then I was a cartoonist, editorial cartoonist, illustrator, then a feature writer, news writer, and then edited the monthly magazine. And I did every kind of job they would let me do there, because there was no better education than the Daily Illini. Like, they treated us like professionals, and we worked for a professional paper that competed with the News Gazette, the adult-run paper. And we had no interference whatsoever editorially that I knew of. I only worked with other college students, and we put out a paper every day. And so it was incredibly thrilling and a real honor to be part of that. And I'm still in touch with so many people from the DI. But then, you know, right after college, you know, my parents died when I was a senior. And so I, you know, we had to move to, everything was, you know, everything changed. And so I moved to California with my sister and little brother, and we started over. So that all of those decisions were kind of made for me about what was going to be next. And so, but I still, you know, in San Francisco, I started at working in the promotions department of the San Francisco Chronicle, and the editorial and cartooning I did for SF Weekly. And then when Salon started, I started at Salon. So I was working, again, like five different jobs to make ends meet, but I had a lot of good opportunities here in SF.
More to come from my December interview with author Dave Eggers, whose latest book is The Captain and the Glory. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. It's the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been revisiting my December conversation with novelist and journalist Dave Eggers, whose latest book, The Captain and the Glory, is an allegory about contemporary American politics. It's about a ship that replaces a beloved, experienced captain with someone who is none of those things, but the people say, at least he's shaking things up. Dave, I don't want to spoil the ending, but I put down your book feeling at least somewhat optimistic, right? The ship is not great, but there's mostly young people coming back. There's a sense that the Glory might be redeemed. I wonder, was the book always going to take that course? Why did you want to
end
it?
I didn't know how it was going to end, to be honest. But, you know, this is a ship of a few thousand people, and they go through what I consider a fever, where they succumb to, I think, authoritarian tendencies. Their interest in disruption or shaking things up at all costs puts them all in incredible danger and risks the values that bind them and all the principles for which the Glory, this boat, this ship, stands. And then at the end, it's up to a group of small vessels that periodically come to the ship seeking solace and safety. They are the ones that have recovered all of these books of principles and traditions and rules and guidelines that the captain has thrown overboard over the past, during his tenure. And so they've been seeing these books floating on the water, and they say, did you lose these? Maybe you want these back. And so they're really, you know, refugees from all over the seas that find these books floating, take them in, and restore them to the Glory. And so I came, you know, that ending sort of wrote itself in a way, because it does reflect how I believe. I do think that we will go back to our better selves, and whether Republican or Democrat, we will again, I think, come back to the belief that the White House should have a certain dignity to it. The person that occupies it should be respectful of our Constitution, of our history, of Congress, of our intelligence gathering, of our allies, of international law, of teenage climate activists. You know, that person should be a dignified role model of, at least should be attempting to be so. And we've abandoned that belief. We really, no matter what part of the political spectrum you're on, you cannot say that the occupant of the White House is a role model in any aspect of his behavior. And I think that is something that is really beyond debate. I don't think any tax cut is worth sacrificing our dignity as a nation.
I don't hear supporters say that either, that, you know, that he's a role model, even if they still support him and would vote for him again.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of his policies could be enacted by a dignified human on the Republican side, and we wouldn't have to deal with the constant embarrassment and shame and cruelty and excoriation of vulnerable peoples and bullying, all of these things that just are unacceptable from a head of state. And so, you know, I grew up in an independent household, a libertarian household. My older brother worked for George W. Bush. I know every part of the political spectrum, and I can really understand and talk to anybody. But this is something different. I just don't, the lack of honor and the incredibly base crudity and cruelty is just something that I don't find acceptable.
We've been speaking with Dave Eggers. His latest book is The Captain and the Glory. It's an allegory about American politics. Dave, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Brian. Good to talk to you.
And now we go from books to another form of entertainment and escape during this pandemic. The theater, or more specifically, the drive-in movie theater, that is.
Show starts in 1 minute. Please remember to replace the speaker on the post when you leave the theater.
In the 1950s, Illinois had more than 100 drive-ins. Now that number has dwindled to fewer than a dozen. While indoor movie theaters are closed, though, drive-ins were able to open up last week, making them one of the rare forms of public entertainment that's still available right now. Joining us are two Illinois drive-in theater owners. Mike Haroon has owned the Harvest Moon in Gibson City for more than 30 years, and Doug Knight is owner of Route 66 Drive-In in Springfield. Mike and Doug, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
So, Mike, I want to start with you. For those who have not been to the theater there, can you tell us a bit about Harvest Moon Drive-In in Gibson City? What would it be like on a summer evening, at least before the pandemic?
Well, before the pandemic, we had a carousel we ran free. We have a train that we run for free for the kids. And then we have grass areas in front of both screens that the kids would play in. And it was like going to a big tailgate party, and people really had a good time. We allowed pets and stuff like that.
And cars could be closer together, I guess. People could sit outside
their
cars.
Two cars between the poles. That's all changed now. But obviously, it's a lot different right now. But we're doing it for the safety of our patrons. We do one car between two poles, so there's probably 15 feet apart between people. Our concession, you no longer can go inside of it. We have walk-up windows, which we keep spacing 6 foot apart and stuff like that. And we have somebody, bathroom attendants that are constantly cleaning after everybody. And it's more labor-intense right now, but it's just what we have to do to be safe.
Mm-hmm. And Doug, what about you? Can you tell us about the Route 66 drive-in?
Yeah, it's a 12-screen. We hold about 252 cars on each side. Right now we're limiting that to 125. We're skipping every other spot. Unlike the Harvest Moon, we don't have the poles still in our place. We just paint some stripes. And, again, you can't have people inside, so we have an app where they can order their food, and then they get a text when it's ready, and then they come to the window for pickup. Same for the gate. We do advanced sales only. We're not allowed to handle any cash at the gate, so they come in with the barcode on their phone or a piece of paper, and we scan it and let them in.
And so both of your drive-ins opened this past weekend, as I understand it. Mike, is this about when the time of year when your theater in Gibson City would normally open for the season?
No, we actually would open the 1st of April, the end of March.
Okay.
Would have been a normal opening. We're a little over a month later. I'm just grateful we can open.
Yeah, and Doug, what about you? Same question. Same time frame for Route 66?
Yeah, typically the first weekend of April, we open, unless there's a blockbuster comes out the week before, we might open a week early, but usually the weather's pretty stable by then that people can get out and enjoy. And, of course, they can't be out of their cars right now either. They have to be in their cars. So,
yeah,
bit of a re-education process what the ramps are for, because lots of people don't understand what they're used for. So,
you know, it's interesting you mentioned a big blockbuster, but we've obviously seen movie studios delaying a lot of big releases until the fall. The James Bond movie, the next Marvel movie, Black Widow. Doug, I'm wondering, are you able to get prints or hard drives or however movies come these days? Or, I mean, if you need to, can you pop a classic Blu-ray in there? How does the process work of getting movies at this time?
Yeah, we have the capability of doing both. If we do get a classic, we use a Blu-ray. But right now we're running stuff that came out after January, more towards the March, and then we'll probably be backing up end of the year. This weekend we've got Call of the Wild and 1917 playing, and we just finished up with Trolls, and or finishing up with Trolls and Oh, gosh, it's escaping me right now, the Invisible Man.
That's all right. Mike, what about you? Are you able to get the movies you want, or what does your programming look like?
Well, right now we just did Trolls and Far Away, and it's not what it normally would be. We're doing the best we can. The good thing about the movie studios, they're being a little nicer about the older prints. Let us have some content to put on the screen, and that helps. Mm. I mean, I'm sure when the movies come out, if we can get them, they'll let us have them. But like you said, there's been such an upset in the whole distribution deal. It's just, you got to wait like everybody else. You know, they want to make money too, and I understand that.
Yeah. And Mike, I understand you've also been opening up your drive-in theater to like school graduations and ceremonies too.
Yep. We've got a couple of those scheduled, and we have one wedding that's going to be there. And it's just, we have one church service coming from Champaign. They asked us, and I said, yep. And we're not charging for any of that. We're trying to be good, give back. You know, it's a tough time for everybody. That's the one thing I can say. It's true. We are all in this together. So
sure. And Mike, obviously, drive-in movie theaters have struggled around the country in recent decades with Netflix becoming more popular. And there are only about, I think the stats our producer found, about 300 drive-in theaters around the country still left. I mean, do you view this in some way as an opportunity for people to rediscover the drive-in? As I said earlier, there aren't a whole lot of other public entertainment options available right now.
Well, it definitely is, because normally we'd have competition with everything, which we've always been pretty strong. I've been pretty blessed that way. But like this year, with no county fair, no state fair, graduations, all the things that normally would take away from us are not there. No ball games, no nothing. So we're pretty well the only entertainment you're going to get right now, and I hope the other opens up soon. You know, we're going to do the best we can, because we can only run half capacity. Mm-hmm. And it's still, like they said, we can't allow people to be out of their vehicles. It's nothing close to any normal, but it still gets you out of the house, and it's better than being trapped in. How's that?
Yeah. And Doug, similar question to you. I mean, the Route 66 drive-in, for people who are not familiar with it, this is on the south end of Springfield. It's part of a much larger entertainment complex called Knights Action Park. There's water slides, go-karts, mini golf. I wonder, what is your outlook for the summer overall?
Well, we were hoping to start opening after this June 1st, after the shelter-at-home order, but that does not look with this new five-phase plan, the governor's new five-phase plan. It's going to be, it could be the end of June, 1st of July before we get anything open right now. I mean, it's kind of crazy and scary, because I've got a finite season. I mean, when school starts, my season's over, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And have you had to, I mean, have you had to, I don't know, lay off staff or just hold off on hiring? I imagine you have a lot of young people who come to work there and, you know, as lifeguards and that sort of thing.
Well, we've got our staff hired, and I was fortunate enough to get in on that payroll protection program. So I think I've got my labor expense covered through about the third week of June, which will help a little bit. But after that, I'm hanging out there on my own. So at least my employees are really afraid that they're not going to be able to have a job or earn any money to go back to school with. So,
sure.
And I get it. You know, they're asking if they're going to be a lifeguard, if they can do something else and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, you know, we got so many positions to go around, so we're hoping for the best.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us today. Doug Knight is the owner of the Route 66 Drive-In in Springfield, and Mike Haroon is owner of Harvest Moon Drive-In in Gibson City. Doug and Mike, thanks again for being here with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Tomorrow, we're working on a story about gap years. If you're a high school senior who's considering taking a gap year because of the pandemic, or maybe if your plans for the fall have changed, send us an email, talk@21stshow.org, or better yet, you can send us a voicemail. Or a voice memo, I should say. You record it on your phone, email it to us. We've posted a video on how to do just that at the top of our Twitter page. Once again, if you're a high school senior considering a gap year, send us a voice memo or an email, talk@21stshow.org.
that 21st show, or you can tweet us at 21stshow, which is also where we tweet out links with more of what we're talking about on the program every day. You should also subscribe to our podcast so you never miss a segment. You can find that on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director, and a special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.